Thank you very much. So I was going to focus, as an example of what was just said, I was going to focus on biomaterials. And so to tell you a little about myself, so I, as was mentioned, I got my degree at Cornell in 1970, and then I went to, in chemical engineering, and then I went to MIT and got my doctorate there. But then I did something very different for a chemical engineer. I actually went to work in a hospital, in a surgery department. And I got involved in a lot of things there and did a lot of research. But one of the things I noticed that I was very curious about, because I was doing a lot of work on materials, was how did materials find their way into medicine? So this was 1974 at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And what I noticed was pretty much every time somebody used a material in medicine, it was largely driven, innovation-wise, by a medical doctor who urgently wanted to solve the medical problem that they were facing. And what they did, pretty much exclusively, is they went to their house and kind of found an object in their house that kind of resembled the organ or tissue they wanted to fix. Let me illustrate. So, I'm sorry, let me... So basically, what would happen is, in the case of the artificial heart, some clinicians wanted to make something with a good flex life. So what they did is they said, what object has a good flex life? And they said, a lady's girdle. And they took, that was 1967, by the way. So they took the material in a lady's girdle and they made the artificial heart out of it. But as people know, that ran into some problems. One of the things that happened when you make an artificial heart is that when blood hits that surface, it can form a clot, and that can cause the clot can go to the patient's brain, they can get a stroke, and they die. Yet if you think about it, something that was designed to be a lady's girdle is probably not the optimal blood-contacting material. But you see, once people started down that path, it was very hard to change it from an FDA regulatory standpoint and so forth. And this problem pervades all of medicine. Dialysis tubing was originally sausage casing, still is. Vascular graft, that's artificial blood vessel. That was a surgeon in Texas going to a clothes store to see what he could sew well with. Surgeons actually do a lot of sewing. Breast implants. One actually was a lubricant, the other a mattress stuffing. You can probably think of the logic. And this problem for the entire 20th century pervades all of medicine, still pervades it largely today. But I remember thinking, you said I learned chemical engineering at Cornell and then at MIT, and one of the things that that you learn when you take chemical engineering is maybe you don't always get things from your house, maybe you could use chemical engineering design principles. So that what you could do is ask the question from a biomaterial standpoint, what do you really want in a biomaterial from an engineering standpoint, chemistry standpoint, and biology standpoint, and then maybe you could make it, synthesize it from scratch. And so that's how I sort of began a lot of the things I began doing, and I thought I'd just give you a few examples. First example, actually, was when we started, the only material that was approved by the FDA that was degradable and implantable was these polyesters. They dissolve like this. They start out on the top part, but then over time they get spongy, which you can see in the second panel. And then if you look in the third panel, you see them breaking apart. Now, if you put a drug in there, and a lot of times people do want to put drugs in for drug delivery purposes, if it breaks apart, and that, as you see in the third panel, could just lead to bursts of drug coming out. And if you had a drug like insulin or an anti-cancer drug, that would be a very bad way for it to happen. So we said, from an engineering standpoint, we don't want it to dissolve like this, even though almost all materials did. We said we want materials to dissolve like this, what we call surface erosion. More like the way a bar of soap dissolves. And we said that we were going to try to come up with a series of materials to do this. And over a period of 5 or 6 years, we did exactly that. We synthesized a family of what are called polyanhydrides, and we were actually, by using chemistry, we were able to make them go anywhere from a day to 5 years or any time in between. So we had all these new materials. And of course, one of my big goals is to always make sure that when we make something, that it gets used to help people. And so about 5 years after we started, a young neurosurgeon named Henry Brehm from Johns Hopkins came to see me. And he said, wondered if we could use this as a new basis for coming up with a new treatment for locally delivering drugs to treat brain cancer. And the idea that basically we wanted to do was that before this, when people treated any type of disease or cancer, they would give a drug systemically throughout the whole body, but really you just wanted to act locally. So what they were interested in, the neurosurgeons, was could they operate on the patient, take as much of the tumor out as possible, but before they close the patient up, could they line the cavity, surgical cavity, with little wafers that could slowly release this drug? Now, this drug normally just lasts 12 minutes, but if you put it in the material, it's protected, it'll last for as long as you make the material, say a month or two. And, as you see in the third part, the polymer protects the drug from being destroyed. And most importantly, in the fourth point, it locally delivers the drug. You get high concentrations in the brain where you want it to be, low concentrations in the rest of the body where it causes harm. Now, a lot of people that you're hearing from today, pretty much everyone, are in companies. And so, but if you're in academics and you want to do a project like this, like create new materials and things like that, you have to raise money in a different way. And what all the professors here know is that the way you generally raise money if you're in the medical area is you write research grants to generally the National Institutes of Health, and then they have professors at other schools reviewing them and saying what they think. They're called study sections. And so when I had these ideas, I wrote these grants, I sent them to the NIH study sections, and actually we did very badly. To show you some of the reviews. In 1981, when we first wrote this, the reviewers, the chemists, said we'd never be able to synthesize the polymers. But I had a very good graduate student named Howie Rosen. Howie later would become president of the ALSA Corporation, $12 billion corporation, also was elected to National Academy of Engineering, and he synthesized them. Then we sent the grant back. By the way, the reviews don't come back quickly either, but the We sent the grant back, and the reviewer said, well, okay, because even if we could synthesize them, they're reactive, they'll react with the drug, they'll destroy it. I had another couple of postdocs. Cam Leung, he's now the James Duke professor at Duke University. Bob Linhart, now a Constellation professor, another named chair at RPI in chemistry, and they showed that didn't happen. So we sent it back again. The reviewer said, well, still shouldn't be funded. The polymers are fragile, they'll break. In the body. I had another couple of postdocs, Edith Mathiewicz, who's now full professor of bioengineering at Brown University, and Avi Dohm, who later became chairman of medicinal chemistry at Hebrew University, and they solved all that, didn't happen. So then we sent it back again, and the reviewer said, well, we still shouldn't fund it because new materials, they'll be toxic. I had another graduate student, Cato Lorenzen. He later became the dean of medicine at University of Connecticut, member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering, and he showed actually they were quite safe. Anyhow, this kept going on and on until 1996 when the FDA approved it. It was actually the first time in over 20 years they approved a new treatment for brain cancer and the first time they ever approved this idea of local chemotherapy. You can probably tell from the way I'm speaking that I'm very proud of how well all the graduate students and postdocs who worked on this project did. They became chairpersons, people of major departments, called endowed chairs, CEOs of major corporations, whereas the reviewers at the other universities, they didn't do too well. None were from Cornell, of course. But anyhow, so anyhow, I just want to show you what this actually looks like. If anybody's squeamish and doesn't like the sight of blood, don't look. But here's a picture of a little wafer going into the brain, So I don't like to leave that on too long because one time, actually, my wife came to a talk I gave, and I asked her at the end of it, I said, what did you think? And she said, well, she said, Bob, the talk was all right. Actually, that's extremely high praise. But she went to Harvard, by the way. But anyhow, so she said that's, but she said, you know, you had the, I was talking to a group of engineers. She told me I had those slides on for 10 minutes explaining every detail of the operation. She told me all the engineers were turning green, so I always don't do that. So anyhow, so don't do that anymore. And what's been important, and basically this got approved, it's actually been used for the last 16 years, and it's been one of the ways that people continue to treat people with brain cancer today if they have a localized lesion. Also, the principle and our patents actually would end up being used not only just for this idea, but it would really open the door to all kinds of local chemotherapy, not just in cancer, but actually the biggest application has been in heart disease, where if somebody has heart disease today, one of the most common treatments is to give them what's called a stent. It's a little Chinese finger puzzle shown here. But half the time when you put it into the blood vessel has caused, there's a problem called restenosis. Smooth muscle cells start proliferating wildly. So what they do is exactly the principle we developed. They basically coat these stents with polymers and actually deliver anti-cancer drugs, in this case Taxol rather than BCNU, locally. And this has had a huge effect. I mean, million are used a year, and I think the market's several billion dollars. Also, I kept thinking of other materials that we might make that might change our future. And one idea I had was that there's this whole area of minimally invasive surgery. If you went to a hospital 30 years ago and you had your gallbladder out, they'd make a big incision in you, they'd take the gallbladder out, but you'd be in the hospital for weeks, wouldn't be back to work for months because they did a big operation on you. Now it's very different. Now they make a little incision, they put these scopes down and they take out the gallbladder. You're out of hospital in less than a day, back to work in a few days. And so I thought, gee, if you could take objects out through those holes, there's all these bulky medical devices that are just made of materials. Maybe we could put them in through those holes. Now, that might sound like science fiction, but what if you could make the materials change shape? What if you could just put them in like a string at room temperature and then make them change shape because of a temperature change? So we actually created and synthesized materials that could do that. I'm going to show you a video of a string in room temperature air. Then we're going to drop it into body temperature water, and hopefully it'll change into a coil like a stent. So here's the video. Notice the string at the top. It's just going into the body temperature water, changes to a coil. You could actually make a change to any shape. Let me just give you a second example. Let's say you had a surgical wound on your face or your hand, and you wanted to tie a surgical knot. Well, if it's outside the body, it's pretty easy to do. I could do it. You might not want me to do it, but I could do it. But inside the body, in your lung or your stomach, how could you do it? So we thought, well, what if you made the knots tie themselves? What if you looped in a loose knot like a lasso, but then when it gets to changing of temperature, it just tightens? Let me show you a second video. So here, notice the loose knot in the center, and it's dropping into water, it just tightens. So you can basically make these do almost anything. And by the way, we've actually published ways to not only do it by temperature, but also by light, so you could use a fiber optic. Now, the last idea I wanted to mention was taking these ideas even further. Could we actually not only just put materials in, but materials plus cells in to make someday new tissues or organs? So this actually I started about almost 30 years ago working with Jay Vacanti, who's a friend of mine and a surgeon, head of pediatric surgery at Mass General. Our idea was this. If somebody needed a new tissue or organ, what if you took whatever cell you want? You could take stem cells too, but people didn't talk about them then. But you could convert them into these cells, put them on a scaffold, grow them in what we call a bioreactor, and make a new tissue. And over the years, we worked out all different kinds of principles where we could grow these cells, make these polymer scaffolds, and make new tissues. And just to give you a couple quick examples of where they're now used, one actually has been approved by the FDA for burn victims for artificial skin and patients with diabetic skin ulcers. Let me show you this. Here's a little baby, very badly burned, actually 2 years old, very badly burned. You can take the product, though, which are neonatal skin fibroblasts, put them on this polymer scaffold like this. You can actually cryopreserve it, put it in the child at the time of injury, looks like this. Come back 3 weeks later, it looks like this. 6 months later, looks like this. We've applied it to a lot of other areas too, like cartilage and others that are in animals and sometimes clinical trials. I thought I'd end with some of our most recent work. We're actually trying to apply it to spinal cord repair. Here we've worked with a variety of people where we've started by Aaron Levick, one of my students, who's now a professor at Case Western Reserve, and there's even a company in vivo now trying to develop this. But basically what we've done is we have these scaffolds, we can put cells on them, and let me just show you what we've done in these cases is to make rats paraplegic and follow them for 400 days. And let me just show you what happens when that's done. This is another video, and this is pretty typical. This is the rat at 100 days, and we did about 50 of these. But the key things to notice, there's actually a scoring system, are the paws are splayed in a rather awkward fashion, and he cannot support his hind limbs. He can't support his weight. That's pretty typical of these injuries. But then what we did is we took these same kind of rats, made the same lesions, and then put a tissue-engineered spinal cord in, which is the polymer with the neuronal stem cells. And now this happens, also at 100 days. It's not a cure by any means, but he's somewhat awkward. He's actually a bit heavy, too. But he's able to support his own weight, and the paws are splayed in a much more normal fashion. So we did this, and over the past 6 years, we always try to move this to patients. Actually, with working with this company in vivo, and Eric Woodard and John Slotkin, two very good neurosurgeons, we've now applied this to primates to try to get it ready for humans. My wife told me not to leave that on too long either. So let me just show you the primates, and this is the last panel. It's a primate. If we look at this panel, it's just the one leg that's treated, and he could get polymer cells by themselves, but they don't do anything. But the panel on the right in a second will start, and you'll see that he does better. Again, not a cure, but it's an improvement. This is after about 10 weeks. So basically, to me, what I've tried to get across then this morning is that materials, I think, have really, really there has not been a lot of, I think, interesting chemical and biological engineering in the 20th century. But I hope this is just the tip of the iceberg for the 21st. And actually, if you go to Cornell's engineering departments in Ithaca, some of my students are there and lots of other great people, and they're doing all kinds of wonderful work like this. Anyhow, thank you very much. Thank you.